Okay, there we go. Now it's live. Okay, it said failed to go live. I'm like, oh no, not Jacqueline Battalora, no. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back live on the Philippe Matthews Show. Thank you for tuning in. Historical day. Dr. Jacqueline Battalora is back with us. As you know, she's an attorney and professor of sociology and criminal justice at St. Xavier University in my home, in my cold hometown, Chicago, where it's now 12 degrees. She's also an anti-racist writer, educator, and trainer who is the author of the book, Birth of a White Nation, The Invention of White People and Its Relevance Today. And today we're going to be unpacking Bacon's Rebellion. Welcome back, Dr. Battalora. And you're frozen, and did we lose you? I think we lost you. Uh-oh. Is this what we call a technical difficulty? I think so. I don't know if you can hear me, Doc. If you can, you might have to log off and come back on, but you froze there and I can't hear you, or and you're frozen in the back. So this is what happens sometimes with technology, people. We have to do these things. So I have to call her to let her know that she's frozen. She might think that she's not. All right. Okay, calling Doc right now. This is going to be a great show, though, once we get the tech stuff going here. Okay. Oh, the power went out. Yeah, I just mentioned to the people, because I just mentioned that it's 12 degrees in Chicago. The power went out. I knew something happened. I said, "Where the hell she go?" We were just getting ready. We just had steak and wine. It was great. Okay, so you're coming back. Okay, the power went out. It's coming back. Oh, you got to reboot. You're in the dark. Oh wow. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, she's coming back on. There she is. Okay, we can hang up the phone. Hey, that's normally this is what happens in the green room, but it's live right now. This is great. People are seeing this stuff for the first time. They're like, whoa, this really happens. Yes, it does. Blackouts happen, and you know, no pun intended according to the content that we're talking about today, but that's what happened. All right, so you're back. We're talking about and unpackaging Bacon's Rebellion today, Doc, but we need to kind of go back and kind of set the tone of why we do this show, why we have you back again and again and again, and why it's so relevant and so necessary and so important. Talk to us about the invention, the legal invention of white people, because it's not normal to be white.
Well, we know that as a matter of law, the category called white people did not exist prior to 1681. We also know that before 1681, persons of African descent in colonial North America had the same rights as European people who held the same status as a matter of law. And we know there were plenty of free persons of African descent. They're on the public records. Again, I'll hold up a critical legal resource. Edmund Morgan's book is foundational to this historical period. And we know that following a huge rebellion in the colony of Virginia, the lawmakers were scared as hell that this could happen again. And so in their communications to the legal oversight authority in London, they said, we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again, and we're going to deploy a divide and conquer strategy to ensure it doesn't happen. And there the work of Theodore Allen is crucial, because his historical work dove into the letters, the communications going back and forth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So following this revealing information that they intended to use a divide and conquer strategy, that's when we see this whole new category of humanity called white people. And it was asserted in law to create, to completely reorganize colonial society in a way that created an entirely new bottom to that society and tossed persons of African descent and members of native tribes into this new constructed bottom, which was created by law, doing things like passing laws that made it illegal for a person of African descent to testify against a white person, laws that made it illegal for a person of African descent to run for public office, which They obviously could before, or you wouldn't need that law. And a bundle of other laws that conferred unearned advantages, in other words, advantages given just by virtue of holding this status called white, to white people, and giving unearned disadvantages to people who were not white.
And in our previous shows, thank you for that, by the way, and in our previous shows, as a result of understanding what these laws did, there was only really two reasons that white people exist today. And share that with us, as, and then we'll go into Bacon.
Absolutely. White people were invented for the reason that Virginia lawmakers stated, to divide workers, to divide us from laborers from each other, to divide the 99% who had joined together in Bacon's Rebellion. So the invention of white people divided workers, divided the 99%, and we have served that purpose ever since.
Huge. We had a comment on one of our shows that you and I did, where the gentleman really got it, and he said something, and I'm paraphrasing. He says, this is not a black or white issue. White people were duped as well by the 1%. So this is an issue, even, and not to say that there was not a consciousness of quote unquote colorism and bigotry and prejudice against a color prior to this, but what we're talking about specifically as it relates to America, that this was an intention by the elite, by the 1%. And as a result of that 1%, everyone who was born into America from that moment on, and here we are today, right, if you will, even whites are victim to these anti-miscegenation laws of 1681.
Absolutely. The cost, of course, wasn't nearly as high for white people in the material sense as
absolutely.
It was for non-white people.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't even put it in the same sentence.
But in certain ways.
But collectively, though, we're all paying a price.
And even to, yeah, absolutely. And so white people are paying some of that price. But the daily lived out harm to persons of color, in particular tribal people and persons of African descent, just, you know.
Yeah, it's unfathomable. But now here's the thing. The people to blame for this is not, you know, I try to do a conscious show. I try to have intelligent conversations and that are not emotional, and try not to do a this versus them versus us dialogue, where we say all white people are bad and this, you know, they're just, you know, this, they're this and they're that, and what we're doing is looking at who started this mess.
Right.
That's really what we're doing. Who started this mess and why? And who benefits from this classification of being white? Now, of course, white people. But we understand now that the privileges that you talk about, which now, you know, back in 93, I think it was, Dr. Peggy McIntosh, you know, created the term white privilege. Right. That even though there are poor whites, people who feel they're not privileged, who are, you know, just as economically oppressed, if not more, than some blacks, but because of this intergenerational legal entity called white people, that even the lowest class of whites, what we, and I, you know, I guess I could say this on my show, it's the internet, it's not censored, what we call poor white trash, literally still has, are better off than the lower class of being melanated or being black or African American. And that's the system that was legally put into place by the elites so that they would not, again, as you said, have this level of rebellion. So how am I doing with that, Doc? Did I do that right?
Fantastic.
Okay, good. So that being said, how did this start? Well, it started with Bacon's Rebellion. Well, a lot of people don't understand Bacon's Rebellion. So let's talk about that. Unpackage Bacon's Rebellion and what, because it had to be, because you think about what issued and ushered in slavery, chattel slavery, and made white people on top and everybody else on the bottom, and then it spread around the frickin' world. You have to understand what the hell Bacon did. you know what I'm saying? I'm talking about that had to be, at that time, like a 9/11.
Right.
For colonialism, it had to be their 9/11 in order for them to institute something that would dehumanize an entire population of people, and still are doing it to this day, and then spread around the world and became the norm. Walk us through Bacon's Rebellion and why it's so historical and so powerful.
Well, Bacon's Rebellion is was so traumatic to the 1% because it was huge. It was huge. And when I read different historical sources, in one historical source, in a letter written back and forth to the Legal Oversight Authority in London, they said, only about 30% of the colony supported the crown, and meaning 70% were on Bacon's side. Governor Berkeley, who was the governor of Virginia at the time, he noted that you couldn't find more than 5 people who supported the crown. so you get whether he was just exaggerating it is not entirely clear, but nonetheless it makes the point that this was a massive threat to the British colonies. And don't forget, like, these colonies came about because some rich people in England and the crown wanted to make money. It was their corporation, right? They came over here and expected to exploit the resources and the workers and bring back the dough. And the king was living off of the taxation from all of the tobacco sales.
Wow. So you had, as we've had shows, everybody at one point was equal. But as with most labor issues, the people were fed up and were being abused.
Well, there were some.
Everybody, black, white, Africans, non-African, everybody was being abused. And it got to a point where it, as they say, the hit the fan.
Absolutely. So many things converged to make life extremely difficult for the masses in Virginia. I mean, I'll say just a few, and there were many, many more. The tobacco prices plummeted, and that's pretty much all they grew. They were, because the availability of workers from England who would come over as indentured servants began to decline. They needed the workers that they had to work longer, and so they, for minor infractions, they added many years to their term of service. So punishments were getting really excessive. In addition, even for those who had completed their term of service, the king gave most of the good land to his friends. And so there wasn't even land available for them to take to make their own fortune or their own way in the world. So
there was no way out.
It was harsh. Things were
the have and the have nots at the highest level.
Yeah. So Bacon, Nathaniel Bacon didn't have to look very far to find disgruntled people to join his effort. Not far at all.
Wow. So you have. And 70%, that's huge. That's a huge number. Who did not honor the crown. And, you know, we always talk about and joke about blaming the British for everything. But damn it, in this case, we're blaming the British. Or at least I am, anyway. So now, walk us through how this rebellion from Nathaniel Bacon began to unfold, because this is more than the million women march around the globe protesting against Donald Trump. This is more than Black Lives Matter protesting after the death of Mike Brown or Freddie Gray. Yeah. this was something that went into literally war. I mean, it was a military level threat. Mm-hmm. Walk us through that so we can kind of get an understanding. Because again, you know, this, as you said, it scared the out of the elite. And they said, we have to do something radical and harsh and crazy that this will never, ever happen again. And if you will, racism became an institution by law as a result of that.
It created
over time
a structure, yes, that allowed for this thing that we now think of as race that emerged in the 19th century to take hold. Absolutely. So, okay, so here's what we need to know about Bacon's Rebellion. This rebellion lasted well over a year. So, you know, we think about rebellion maybe a few days, a week. No, no, no.
Right, right.
This lasted well over a year. And there were two phases of it. The first focused on Native Americans. There was tremendous hostility created. And Nathaniel Bacon was particularly perturbed because he had some British servants who were killed, and they assumed it was tribal people who killed them, so they wanted to retaliate. And the lawmakers in Virginia wouldn't support it because they, of course, had agreements with the native tribe who served to protect most of the British from the hostile native people who perceived them as invaders. So the first part of Bacon's Rebellion, and Nathaniel Bacon himself, focused largely on slaughtering tribal people. And the second half of the rebellion is the one that focused on the ruling elite, because they were furious. They were watching themselves, those who came here under terms of indenture, and those who were small farmers, just not able to compete. And they were incredibly frustrated. And so they were looking around them, and they were watching these large landholders and the ruling elite getting really rich. And in fact, one of the ways in which they became wealthy was they paid themselves these exorbitant fees for each day that they sat and met to talk about laws. In fact, it was double what the folks in London got paid for the same work. So the burgesses, those who made the House of Burgesses, the lawmakers. Yeah, so the corruption among the elite was incredible. And in fact, it got even worse after Bacon's Rebellion. But there is one other thing to note about the rebellion itself, and that is that England sent ships of troops in to finally quash the rebellion.
When we talk about this rebellion, like I said, it was military. I mean, what did... Was Bacon a military? And you know, Bacon wasn't a saint. He was not a good guy. And we have to look at the double negative here is that you came over and slaughtered the indigenous people.
Right.
To take their land from them and name it America. So you're already messed up there. Then, as a result of the conquering, you have a group of Indians who are going to protect the 1%, the elite, from the other Indians who are just will kill them on sight.
Right.
And so, you know, again, we're kind of looking at where does this fear come from of where whites have to have arms.
Right.
You know, we're talking like a kind of epigenetically moving now into the NRA. Can you understand the actual fear where they woke up every day wondering if the people who they conquered are going to kill them, turn on them, betray them to try to get their land back? And that did happen.
Sure.
And then you usher in slavery, you know, hundreds of years later, chattel slavery, and then you have slaves who you dehumanized, who you rape, who you kill, who you murder, their children, their daughters and sons, and you have to wake up every day and wonder if they're going to kill you.
Right.
Look at the, and so all of this is going on from this one, from the fear of rebellion, not just from Bacon, but the fear of rebellion from the people who they just conquered and took their land from. And here comes Bacon really stirring up the pot. And I mean, it could have been a completely different America.
Absolutely.
Had Bacon won and had been successful. Because you're saying only 70% had already said, you know what, we don't, there's no way out of this. You know, I'm an indentured servant. There's no way out. There is no middle class. There's nothing I can aspire to.
Right.
And so as a result, we began to look at the consciousness of these people that began to develop this third class and create these laws of 1681.
Here's the other, there's a couple other things, and I'm sorry, you actually asked me to name the two functions of the invention of white people. Of course, number one is it worked
right
for white people. Number two, it secured patriarchy among and within white men. And the other thing that it did was that, and I think as Americans, we can't fully grasp how significant this one is, but it worked to create an alliance between the ruling elite and this new group called white people that was a huge feat, that any sort of connect could be made between laborers, now seen as white, and the ruling elite. Because you have to understand, in England, the ruling, the poor whites were, they weren't whites, poor British people were despised and hated. They were seen as, tell me if this sounds familiar, they were seen as lazy. They were seen as needing to be under other people's rule, whipped and beaten and thrown in institutions. It was at this historical juncture around the time of Bacon's Rebellion when in London, poor English people were being institutionalized in workhouses because they were seen as incapable, better to have them forcefully working and contributing to the wealth of the nation than to be free, mm-hmm. you know, to be able mm-hmm. to make choices for themselves. So that the kind of language that was used by elites in England to describe poor British transferred easily upon persons of now seen as persons of color in the British colonies. And
but there had to be a law that was put into place to institutionalize that, because as you said, how do you create these laws and make them consequential?
Absolutely. Well, and I think we've talked on the show before about there was a dappling of laws before this onslaught of laws that occurred after Bacon's Rebellion. And
right.
and most of the there were
1664, I think it started.
In the 1640s, they had passed a law that was meant to make it illegal for persons of African descent to be in possession of gun or a powder. But we know that it wasn't enforced, that it was it just sort of dribbled off the books and was not enforced at all. So, but what we know that they learned probably from that, and because after Bacon's Rebellion, we saw that these laws were bundled. There was groupings of them. And these laws didn't just do one little thing. They fundamentally reorganized colonial Virginia. Mm. And then colonial Maryland and spreading.
Do we lose you again, Doc? Okay, there you go. Okay, say again. Say that last part again because we lost you.
Well, the bundles of laws that were passed after Bacon's Rebellion, it wasn't just a dapple here and a little thing there. They were massive transformations of colonial Virginia, radically transforming the society. And we can only really understand that if we really get that prior to this moment, to the assertion of those packages of laws that asserted and invented white people, before that, people who held the same status, meaning if you're enslaved or indentured, then you were treated the same. If you were free of indenture or free of enslavement, you were treated the same as a matter of law in terms of how you were treated by a landholder. As long as we understand that life was the same at the same status and class, whether you were from Africa or from England or from Portugal or from Holland, didn't matter. And that, with this package of laws, changed radically.
Wow. And it took, as you said, it took some years for that to manifest itself, because it was easy to break that law, because what was the consequences of those laws? Because you said, who would care? Who would care that you can't do certain things? I mean, we do that now with certain laws, right? Because, you know, and not only that, just ignorance of the law.
Right. But these laws, this bundle of laws, were required to be read on the courthouse steps and be recited at church on Sunday 2 times every year.
Wow.
You had to know these laws. And not, wow. It's unlikely that people didn't know them, because you would know them by how your work life was reconstituted.
Mm-hmm.
Because they required now that this new group of people called white people be in a position of authority relative to persons, tribal people and persons of African descent on the same, you know, working for the same person, the same large landholder.
So Bacon, so this rebellion, as you said, went on for over a year. What transpired within that year that caused the British to have to, because imagine now in modern day times, do you know what level of decimation or invasion we would have to deal with in order for another country to come in and help us?
Hmm.
Let's look at that for a moment. What happened in the 1600s? So you can kind of get an idea of what happened in that year. And this, when we talk about a threat level, both, you know, foreign and domestic, this was it. So Nathaniel Bacon, that was the dude, as it relates to scaring the, you know what, out of this 1%, where they had to ask for help from another country militarily to come in. And that was really, if I understand, the only thing that ended it.
Well, it was their colony.
Looks like the colonial cats would lose it.
Well, it was a British colony, so it was their own country.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, we've talked a number of times about sort of this rise of chattel slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, Edmund Morgan's work, American Slavery, American Freedom, really gets into the why slavery and why what we would articulate today as racialized black, why.
Mm-hmm.
And he really shows pretty clearly that it was very much an economic, there were economic motivations. For example, when you look at survival rates of indentured servants, an indentured servant cost roughly half as much as a stolen body purchased, a stolen body from Africa purchased. Okay, so that was twice as much as an indentured servant. So for that economically to be worthwhile, you have to have survival rates that make it a good economic choice.
Mm-hmm.
And part of where we see the shift into chattel slavery is when survival rates in the colony start to make that economic choice a good economic choice.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and there's some other really interesting things to note too, and that is that the English set up a monopoly for their slave trade to begin, but we know that many persons of African descent came from, I believe, Barbados, were purchased sort of illegally outside of the England's monopoly there, and that what was pretty extraordinary for us to realize about that group is they already spoke English.
Mm.
Many persons of African descent, because they had already been enslaved on this island working to produce sugar And they wanted to leave because growing sugar is so much more taxing on your body than working a tobacco field. Not that it's easy, but relatively.
Sure, relatively, yeah. One hell to another hell, yeah.
Yeah, so it enabled these the first groups of persons of African descent to connect with the British who they worked alongside. You know what I mean? That it helps us to understand how, mm-hmm. especially when you think about cultural differences and language differences, okay. how it is that these people could treat each other the same in a similar fashion, live together, eat together peaceably. And I think understanding some of that helps us to see how that could occur.
Absolutely fascinating. So when we look at this attack, this rebellion, and we have had this conversation that there had to be something going on for them to do it in that way. Like you said, economics was one. Edward Morgan talks about that, but there had to be some level of prejudice, which at that time was probably what it was called, because racism wasn't concretized yet, if you can imagine. But there had to be some kind of this, the them versus us consciousness or mindset for them to create the economics from that platform.
Sure. Well, let me offer this as part of the picture.
Okay, great. Thank you.
England prohibited slavery, the enslavement of its own people. So the law already had a structure that protected that group from being enslaved. However, even though they didn't approve of slavery, if they wouldn't challenge buying a slave. So that's what the British colonists did. They bought persons who were already viewed as slave because the law did nothing to challenge that, and it just turned a blind eye to it. So that began this sort of very different view of bodies. And then soon thereafter, it's noteworthy that the Virginia lawmakers did actually pass an explicit law that allowed for the enslavement of tribal people and persons of African descent.
Okay.
It did then get approved by the legal oversight authority in England, in London.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about Bacon's Rebellion, as we're unpacking this, we're talking about someone who could have easily overthrown the government. Mm. Right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, during the rebellion, is for the second phase of it, these, groups of bandits, as they were referred to by those loyal to the crown. Those who were loyal to the crown had their homes plundered. They would regularly get in a home, take what they want, burn what they didn't.
Wow. Wow. So, in one sense, we could look at that as really the first war mm-hmm. of America, was on American soil, first domestic terrorism, if you will, on American soil, because it was trying to be a hostile takeover, but it was two hostile takeovers. It's fascinating. It's like the colonial, the Virginians were kind of getting their stuff back, if you will. Mm-hmm. As a result of Bacon's Rebellion, because what they had stolen in the first place was not working, and people were rebelling, and because you had these servants, slaves and indentured, but you also had these people who were uneducated.
That's right.
So they legally couldn't fight, but they could physically fight.
Right.
And that, right? And we see that today.
Sure.
And so the goal was is like, okay, how can we set laws and that we can militarily back up? And that's kind of what happened as a result of these, what we now call anti-miscegenation laws, miscegenation laws of 1681. And then there were several that you said dappled after that, that kind of clustered together over a period of time that ushered in chattel slavery. I want to go back to a point that you made earlier, Doc. I was watching last year, actually, I think last year around this time, Roots, the remake, was airing, and I had Dr. Myron Haley on the show, who was the co-author of Roots with her late husband Alex Haley. And there was a scene in the first Roots in the 70s, as well as this remake. There was a scene in there that I think a lot of people didn't see, or maybe just overlooked. And that was what you spoke about the British hating poor whites.
Yes.
They hated, and in many cases, they said they hate a poor white person more than they hate a black person or a person of African descent. They said there's nothing more vile, nothing more worse. And we kind of see that today when we look at there's a psychosis that comes from poverty. There is a mental illness that comes from not being able to be educated and to not being able to feed yourself.
Yeah.
And we see that manifest itself as a result of what we go through in the African American community, being economically and academically castrated. But when we see that in whites, and we see that in poor whites, because of this new system that we're under, this caste system, well, it's not new, but you understand what I'm talking about. We see that poor whites who had the opportunity, poor uneducated whites, who had the opportunity to have now to have slaves too, treated their slaves worse, perhaps, than even the elite did. Not to say that there's any such thing as better slavery,
right,
in terms of how one is treated as a slave. But when you have a lesser degree of intelligence, emotional intelligence, IQ intelligence, what have you, you act in a more primitive way. And that's across the board. We can see how that manifests itself today. And so I want you to speak to, if you could, bring it home to us today of how poor whites who are academically challenged, if you will, need to understand their level of privilege that they can't grasp because they're poor, they're uneducated, they had to scrapple and do what they had to do to make it, but understand that's part of that institution from the 1% and from the elite. It was designed that way.
Yeah, well, look, I think that the lack of awareness of white privilege is, of course, it gets manifest differently dependent upon economic class.
Sure.
But there's no more evidence that it prevails at higher rates among poor whites than above middle class whites than wealthy whites. White privilege is a blind spot for the vast majority of white people, regardless of class.
Mm.
So I think that's a really important thing to say. But I think what happens is, our nation has its own animosity toward poor people. And so people were real good about pointing out the deficiencies of poor white people, even and the racism of poor white people, because it's can often get expressed in ways that are easy to see and pinpoint, in language, in explicit comments or support of groups. But I think that the expression of white privilege is just as high among middle class white people, but it gets expressed in ways that are coded. So mm-hmm. it's just not so clear to see. Mm-hmm. So I'm always really uncomfortable when we want to use poor white people as the sort of example, because look, and I know people with this election, we know that less educated white for less formal education among white people constituted a group who strongly supported Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's pretty clear that they tapped into this lesson of whiteness that doesn't have to be consciously held at all. Right? Mm-hmm. Look, if I've spent my life since I was born being informed through my, and we talked about this last time too, right? Through my Barbie doll, through my G.I. Joe and my superhero, that through images of God and Jesus and other, you know, if you're a Christian, from a Christian context, everybody who has power and who's held out as an ideal looks like my white self, then I have in my heart and in my brain ingrained an expectation that I'm like them. I'm more special than.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my reality in terms of access to jobs, access to opportunity is not in any way met and in any way consistent with that image of me that's held out as so much better, and especially when I see people who aren't white getting past me, oh my mm-hmm. God, that's insult to injury, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And damn, they're in the White House too?
And especially, right? Yeah.
What? Wait a minute. What's happening to my white America? What the hell is going on?
If we didn't call it Obamacare and just kept with the ACA, nobody would care.
Right. Right.
So many, I think, white, privileged white people cannot handle that a black man filled the White House with such dignity and poise.
Yeah.
Barack
yeah.
Obama.
Yeah.
So I'm saying all that to highlight
the bejesus out of them.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, look at these people who are filling the White House right now. These are not poor white people.
No.
Not at all. And look at the white superiority that they are tapping into and espousing, and they've learned to use code for it, right? They're no different from that label that we can use so loosely, and I just hate, which is white trash. I think it's terrible. And
I'm sorry I used that term, but that's the term I use. I'm very basic when it comes to this kind of thing. That kind of, you got to hit them between the eyes sometimes.
Well, we need to use it to unpack it, because it's a shorthand code.
And even Robin DiAngelo calls herself that. That's where she says she came from.
Yeah. I just, look, I would never, it's my sensitivity because I didn't grow up poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know that my class standing puts me in a position to degrade because of economics, and our country still wants to do it. Like, we blame mm-hmm. poor people for all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And it's insane. And so I just think I prefer to, because in my view, the degree of white privilege that gets expressed, I think, is no greater or less among different class. It gets expressed differently. It's sure. more raw, perhaps, among sure. poor whites. But you know what? Those people filling the White House and those people who are supporting those people filling the White House, they've got dough. They are at least middle class, and most of them much higher. Some of them have been CEOs of major international corporations, and they are espousing the same views of white superiority, or they hold them.
It doesn't have to be deliberate. It can be it's now unconscious because of what happened with the elites in 1681. And so we can look at the White House now and say that, you know, pretty much the same consciousness of people
yeah.
are in there, that 1% who is creating this again, another level of third class.
Yeah.
Through the laws and through, you know, the Muslim ban, it begins there. through the, you know, the Mexican wall begins there. Same level of consciousness, you know, different era, but same time in a sense. And we could also see where these white elites that are now designated white are giving a sense of belonging.
Yes.
And a sense of self-esteem to this designation of whites, even though the middle class and the lower economic class will never be able to achieve that level of wealth, nor will the elite ever have an understanding of, if you will, the people at the bottom. They'll never cross hairs. But it gives them a sense of belonging. And so this designation of white gave
the possibility, right?
The hope.
Yeah, yeah.
The hope that one day I could become an upper echelon, a one percenter.
Absolutely.
And that's really what we're looking at as we unpack this, is that it was just based on hope. How can I protect my white, how can I protect my assets and give the people if you will, kind of a false sense of hope?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because if you don't know the laws that I know, and I'm the lawmaker, I could pretty much, you know, make a separation where you have to really work your butt off to become one of me, to equal me. So I'm going to set these laws up, and I'm going to create an entire designation of people so that there's this third class. So now you feel like you're somebody because you are closer to me than you are to those people down there at the bottom.
That's right.
How did I do?
That's fantastic.
That was my Phil Donahue yeah. Right there.
All right. Well,
you're old enough to know Phil Donahue.
I am. I absolutely. Hey, you know what? There's one little tidbit of information that I thought you would enjoy, and I don't want to forget to share it with you.
Yes, because we're going to close out because I know you got to go.
The armed rebellion, the last holdout of Bacon's rebellion, consisted of a band of laborers, the majority of which were persons of African descent. So the last armed confrontation of the rebellion was majority African American and minority British. Troop, I guess we could call them.
Wow, fascinating. And Bacon died as a result of his injuries?
Yes, I think roughly about midway through the rebellion.
And so the rebellion went on even after his death.
Oh, yeah.
That's something else we haven't really talked about. We still got a couple of minutes, but it's like, yeah, so it still went on.
Oh, absolutely. Again, the anger.
He almost became a martyr in a sense.
The anger and frustration gave a life to this movement, a life of its own, bigger than one person. Like, you know, Black Lives Matter doesn't have a point person, right? It's able to keep, to sustain movement that's not about a Dr. King. Doesn't need Dr. King to do it. And I think just the sheer frustration and desperation and anger among the masses in Virginia kept this rebellion going. And I'd like to share with your with the listeners just one other thing that I think is important to know, and that is once the rebellion was quashed, once the battles were over and the crown regained control, they plundered and punished at will those who didn't support the crown, which were the masses of Virginia. They went in, they passed a law that said, we can go in and take any of your assets because you rebelled against us. And so for those who were already struggling, they lost even more. And a very small group of lawmakers who remained loyal to the crown got tremendous assets for years after Bacon's rebellion, because they continued to plunder and take. And a couple of them went back to London and brought all their goods with them. And it really in combination with these laws. And so anyway, so one of the things I've been wondering about is whether this invention of white people also was a tool to keep, I mean, you think about it. Let's say you and I are mad about the 70% that dared to challenge us, and we're going to go punish them, but there's a hell of a lot more of them than you and I, but we're still going to go punish them and take all their stuff, and we're going to get richer and richer and richer. And then I'm still afraid of them. I don't know about you, but I'm still afraid of them, you know? And yeah, the crown came in, but it was painful before that happened. And, and there's still that big threat. So doesn't the invention of white people, at least relative to its third prong, right, of connecting them with you and me, making them feel like, yeah, maybe they could be as great as us and as wealthy as us, that part of the motivation for the creation too was to appease them so that you and I can more easily scoot on with our accumulated wealth?
Because absolutely,
it was pervasive after the rebellion for years. In fact, the king was furious. But even the king didn't have control over these you know, his own people in Virginia.
Unimaginable, but here we are living it.
Indeed.
Because as you know, it sounds like a movie that you're making up, but no, that's America.
That is America.
This is our hidden history, ladies and gentlemen. This is our this is where you and I came from. And for my white people that are quote unquote white people, or European people, or Eurasians, European descent people who are watching the show, particularly here in America, you're not really white. You're not really white. You think you're white. You might identify and call yourself white, but you ain't white. And that is what this new book that you're writing about is dealing with, and why you write a white biography and naming whiteness. And our goal is for you to find out what your real identity is as a European, because that's what who you are. You're European. You're Scottish, right? You're from Scotland. So what is your new identity going to look like, even though you still are able to live the privileges of this legality called white people, but you're not really white. And I think part of the education, when we have conversations with other people, it's the first thing we should talk about is like, hey, you're really not a white person. So let's start there and say, how did you become white? Do you remember? You know, and that's really the dialogue, I think, that both whites, conscious whites and conscious blacks, need to start having with you know, people of European descent, because it circumvents the whole racism thing and say, well, wait a minute, where did that all of this unpackaging come from? Here is where it comes from. This was an amazing conversation. We really did a lot.
Covered a lot of historical detail.
Yeah. I really appreciate this, but it now I know, you know, where I want to go next with this for our next show. So that being said, anything else we need to take away from Bacon's having a deeper understanding and awareness of Bacon's rebellion, and how and why white people were invented, and what can we do in our daily lives now with this information?
Well, let me just respond to something that came out of your last show that I wanted to remind you of, and that is that I let you know in the green room about that historic reference that your listeners who want to know actual names of the lawmakers,
yes,
who passed these laws, that I will send that to you, and your readers should know that they can go to the actual historic document. It's online. The whole thing's been scanned in. And if you just go to the House of Burgesses, and here's one thing everybody should know, that when you start reading this, F's are S's, right? So it's this old English script. Everything that looks like an F, you pronounce with an S. And you'll see the list of names of the lawmakers in Virginia. And also you'll get to read what they did. And it's a really interesting document. And I'll send you
the link.
The link and folks.
And I'll get it out and get it to our viewers and to our people. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Another great one, Doc.
Thank you, Philippe.
Another wonderful one. Thank you for being you. Thank you for bringing this research out. Somebody asked me, well, you know, there's been people who have already talked about this and they're talking about Edward Morgan and Theodore Allen. And I said, you know what? If I could bring them back to life, they would be on the show.
Absolutely.
But they're not. But Jacqueline Battalora is alive and breathing and she can articulate. So that's why she's on the show. So I appreciate you for being alive and digging up and recovering and rediscovering our true history.
And don't forget Howard Zinn.
Oh, and Howard Zinn, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thanks so we're going to continue this conversation, of course, you know.
Of course.
This is just the beginning, but share this and comment. Let us know what you think. What did you learn? I know there's some people who, I know I learned something today, but there's going to be people who are going to say, oh, you know, this is our history. This is not hyperbole. This is not made up. This is not
alternative facts.
Not alternative facts. You know, this Kelly Conway probably wouldn't approve of this.
Right.
Spicer probably wouldn't approve of this, but it's the truth. It's our history. And so take it or leave it. Stick around with me in the green room, Doc, as we sign off.